They abandoned their belief in the supernatural. Now you are asking me to sabotage that achievement, to send them back into the dark ages of superstition and ignorance and fear? No!
Okay, good evening everyone. It is the 25th of October 2013. It's 7 p.m. in the UK, 2 p.m. Eastern Time in the States, and you're watching Trolling with Logic on our new home at Google Hangouts. We hope you like it. We hope it's tech glitch free when all our fingers and extremities are crossed for what's about to come. So without further ado, like I say, we're a live kind of weekly skeptic slash secular show, covering all kinds of really interesting subjects. Just very quick announcements. You can call in at any time, add the Skype contact, Trolling with Logic, to your Skype, send a little PM with a general gist of your question, and we'll add you in due course. Also, when you call in, you do grant us permission to use your likeness when we upload the shows later. So, again, no funny stuff with DMCAs or that. And another copyright disclaimer is all these shows are public domain, and so feel free to copy and redistribute them at will. So, without further ado, I'll introduce my lovely panel tonight and welcome back Kitch.
Hey guys.
Marty.
Hi everyone.
And Sheila. Welcome to the show, our newbie Sheila.
Thanks, Cal. Hey everyone.
Okay, and I suppose, well, we did a wee practice of this off air, so can our guest, you can introduce yourself. So introducing Mr. Rob Schieffer.
Yes. I've been a skeptic pretty much most all of my life. I was a skeptic before there was skeptic groups. I went to Northwestern, and that was where Galen Hynek was professor of astronomy. He, of course, was the scientific consultant for Project Blue Book for the U.S. Air Force. So he, I guess, had been or seemed to have been a skeptic years earlier, but by the time I got there, he was very much on the believer side and thinking that there was, you know, eyewitness cases were so strong that it couldn't be cast aside. And, well, I had a little different interpretation, but of course I was just a student. But I did get to know Philip J. Glass was at that time the best known of UFO skeptics and probably certainly has been of all time. He wrote like 6 books on the subject. UFOs Explained is the one I'd recommend first to read of the books in Philip J. Glass. And a few years after that, then PSYCOP was formed, the Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal, which has now been shortened to CSI so they can confuse it with crime scene investigators and also with the Church of Scientology International, another CSI. This CSI is the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry. And they've been publishing the Skeptical Inquirer since 1977. I joined the group just a short time after it was formed, and I've been writing a column in the Skeptical Inquirer called Psychic Vibrations, and still continue to write it for each issue. I have made a book now of some of the older columns that I've written. So if you look on Amazon.com, you'll find my book, Psychic Vibrations, is on there. You can order it, paperback. And also, it's I believe it's in all the electronic formats. If you go to JREF, the James Randi Educational Foundation, they have my Psychic Vibrations book as an e-book that you can purchase for not very much. And so I've been, and lately, I started my website, which is debunker.com. And then after that, I now have a blog, which I try to keep up to date, badufos.com. And so now it's sort of that the bunker is more like an archive for some of the older material and the classic cases and the things like Travis Walton and, you know, the ones from the years past, whereas the more up-to-date, the recent developments are on badufos.com. And you can stay up to date more or less with what's happening by reading that.
Do you find very much kind of the UFO sightings and all that, it's very tied into what's in the popular media at the time? Because I remember, like, when I was in high school, the X-Files was very popular, and the papers were full of UFO sightings, and it seems to have kind of declined in recent years. I mean, is that very much what you seem to find?
Well, there's definitely an influence of the mass media, but it's not just as simple as you add up the number of hours of UFO coverage and UFO TV, and that will tell you how many sightings there's going to be. It's a complicated thing. It has to do with news, and it has the news cycle and what people are thinking. For example, back in the 1950s, during the Cold War, we had a number of big UFO sightings, waves, they were called. One of the biggest was in 1957, in the fall of the year. And what had happened was Sputnik was launched in October of 1957. Then all of a sudden, people started seeing all kinds of UFOs. Now, they were not seeing Sputnik because it was not something that was that easy to see. They heard about Sputnik, and they went out to look at the sky, and then they would see an airplane or a meteor or something like that and say, oh, my gosh, there goes one of those UFOs. So you see, it's not a simple thing. It depends on what people have in their minds at times. Certain cases seem to take on an almost mythic status, you know, and it doesn't matter what the facts are. It doesn't matter what facts are discovered. It's almost like religion, you know, in the sense that we now know that the books of the Bible were put together from, you know, in a rather, it was a non-celestial way from different sources and different versions of them. And some of these, you know, contradict each other in what they say. We know this now. So, you know, we don't see it as a, you know, something that's singular and, you know, holy. But the thing is, you know, UFO stories get patched together in the very same way. The more they get told over and over again, each time they get told, it's like a fish. You know, if you ever had an uncle who was a fisherman and said, oh, I caught a fish that was this big 20 years ago. And then each time he would tell the story, his hands would get a little further apart and the fish would get a little bit bigger and a little bit more amazing. And that's basically what happens with classic UFO stories. The same so much over time with the telling and with the feedback that you look at often the original story that these people are telling compare it to the story that you're hearing now, you'll be amazed at how much you've seen.
Marty, do you have a question? I can see you kind of nodding and looking a bit inquisitive.
I'm just nodding along here, but I've done some UFO debunkings myself, and obviously what we hear all the time is video footage. Is that something you spend any time looking at, you know, determining, you know, how was this made or stuff like that?
I've looked at a number of these, but I'm not an expert on video, especially digital video. So I'm really not the one to ask for the technical details, but there are several people who are quite good at that. And in fact, this fellow Mark D'Antonio, who is a MUFON photo analyst, he is a believer in UFOs, and he thinks that extraterrestrials are here. But because he is a professional in the field of video, special effects, and photography, he basically hasn't found people send all kinds of supposed videos for analysis, and he hasn't found any of them that seem to be authentic. So, yes, it's easy to make videos these days. And in fact, as far as still pictures, I have on my blog an entry about these apps you can get on your phone now for Android or for iPhones that will insert UFOs and aliens and things like that in your pictures. And I think similar things exist for video because, I mean, you know, people with video special effects, the software and the equipment can, you know, drum up almost anything. So, yes, there are a lot of claimed videos, but none of them seem to stand up to analysis.
No, I agree with that. I looked at some. There was one in London that was captured by several people in I think it was 2011 or something like that. And I looked at it, and I could just, okay, here's how they did that, and here's, you know, I could spot the, I know what effects were used, so it was really obvious how they faked it. And of course, there were several people who were in on it faking the same thing. So that's how they got it from multiple angles. But I mean, people go to pretty great lengths, it seems, because some of those special effects take a lot of time to make. Do you have any idea what the point of this is? Is it people just looking for a laugh when people say, "Oh, this is real"? Or
I think you may be there. That's the best explanation I can think of when I look at some of these. I mean, I'm sure some of these didn't take more than 15 minutes, and somebody takes a little bitty lens cap and ties it on a thread and hangs it on a fishing pole. And look, there's a flying saucer. These don't take, they're not so hard to do, but like you said, some of these video and other hoaxes are just enormously time consuming and so much care. In fact, there was one, I'm trying to think of what the name of it was, that supposedly tied in from around the year 2006. There were these so-called drone UFOs, there were these spiky things that people were sending around photographs of, and the whole story didn't seem to touch the ground anywhere, that these supposedly came from certain people, but then when investigators tried to find these people, they couldn't actually find them. When they tried to locate where was the picture taken, they couldn't actually find that either. So part one of this was like somebody went to all this trouble to make a whole bunch of these spiky, spindly-looking things with big points coming out of them, supposedly UFOs, flying in the sky. And but then after that, somebody made up what purports to be like a government contractor's document on these things and how supposedly they're built by the government from extraterrestrial technology. And that thing was, 50 pages or whatever, and it's got all these elaborate drawings. And I'm saying, somebody must have spent weeks doing this. Why? I have no idea.
And yeah, the other thing I've noticed, even like when people are fake the footage and they come out and say, "Yeah, I did this, it was a fake," are you still surprised how many folk they still believe it?
Oh, absolutely. Well, yes, we are. That's gone on for a long time, even back in the days of Houdini and Conan Doyle. When Houdini said, "I'm doing all these things with, by trickery and misdirection," and Doyle couldn't bring himself to doubt. And he didn't believe that. He would rather believe that Houdini had supernatural powers that he was using rather than to believe, to fool people.
Yeah, well, there's kind of a sort of on YouTube, a sort of semi-famous case. I think Kitchen Martin will be aware of this. It was a guy took, the World Trade Center, the Building 7, and he doctored the footage. And then, he left it for a few weeks, and all these conspiracy theorists, they were saying, "Look, this is it. This is the proof." And then even when he came out and said, "Look, this is a hoax," and he showed step by step how he did it, they were still clinging on to this. Because he even did something. He put a flying saucer flying out of the debris of the World Trade Center. And he also had on the side of the screen flashing up, "This is a hoax." And he pointed all, and he still clung on to
what
this.
What more could you want? This is a hoax.
I know.
This
it was like, what more could he do to spell out that this wasn't real? And still they were clinging on to this footage. It's really quite incredible. I think I'll hand over. Sheila, we'll let you have your first ever question.
Okay. Do you find that it's the ones that are perpetuating these hoaxes? Do you find that it's more people looking for their 15 minutes of fame? Is it just people who are wanting to stir up the conspiracy theorists? Or have you noticed any sort of trend? Who's putting out the majority of these? What type of people is it?
Well, I think it's a lot of different ones, and I don't think that there's stuff. I certainly can't give you a complete list. What I wrote back in March, I think, from the International UFO Congress, which was in Arizona, and this year, Ben Hansen, I believe it was, here's what he said. He said the following hoaxer subtypes. Ben Hansen is a guy who is on the TV show, Fact or Fake on the Sci-Fi Channel. I don't know if that airs in the UK. But he's a believer in some of these things, but he's a skeptical believer. He exposes hoaxes. So here are his hoaxer subtypes. based on his experience in law enforcement and also a paranormal claim. He says, number one is the clinical con artist who is charismatic and lacks conscience. Claims of persecution by federal agencies, a red flag. There is so much red tape for intelligence actions that these claims are not at all credible. So he basically says anybody who claims to be persecuted by federal or other official governmental agencies, they're a clinical con artist. And he said some of these people have narcissistic personality disorder, and the mentally disordered tend to gravitate to, quote, our field, unquote, which is, of course, UFO studies. And he says type two is legendizers, those who are seeking fame and or financial gain. They may have had a legitimate experience, but you can only tell the same story so many times, so they add more and more excitement each time in bold. Like I was just saying about the fish getting bigger each time that it gets bold about getting more. Then his number three is commercial campaigners, and they say publicity stunts. They're not in it for the long haul. The hoax usually only lasts a few weeks because it damages the credibility of the UFO field and makes people dismiss legitimate cases. Well, I don't know. I feel that bad, but it certainly damages the credibility of the field. Number four, he says, are self-amused pranksters who are motivated by the challenge of pulling it off. And number five, he claims, and I don't agree with this, but he says the rarest type are the disinformation agents. The government changed its story on Roswell repeatedly. The 1956 documentary movie UFO was part of a debunking contingency plan. I think that sounds rather dubious. I don't think the government really cares one way or the other about UFOs and ufologists. I think all they care about is ufologists. Don't bother me. Stay away from me. That's all they care about. So I hope I've answered the question, because when you've asked that question, it occurred to me that I really wasn't in a position to give a detailed answer to it, but that Ben Hansen had already done so.
No, that's fine. It works. Thanks.
Right. I think, Kirch, you've been the quietest so far, so we'll let you jump in now.
See, just coming up with questions there, just to have, just in case. I'm going to start with my first one. It might not be the right time, but assuming that we are at one stage visited by Stephen Hawking would say bad because they could be evil to just basically claim our resources. What's your opinion on whether if we did in fact come in contact with an alien life or an alien civilization, would this be good for us or would this be bad for us, or vice versa, would it be good for them or bad for them or good for them?
Well, it's hard to know for sure. The way I would look at it would be if they are way off in the distance and we are way off in the distance and we are only talking by radio, I would think really there would be no harm to be done, because if I refer back to another blog entry that I did recently on bad UFOs, it's called Is Interstellar Travel Preposterous? Now, preposterous does not mean impossible, but it means so ridiculously impractical that, and it's not just for any level of technology. Even if you could, with 100% efficiency, somehow turn matter into energy and direct that energy behind you as thrust, you still would need absurdly large amounts of matter to get up anywhere near the speed of light. NASA had some advanced ideas as far as what, advanced propulsion systems and things that were being talked about in the last few years. And one of them came from a fellow, in fact, I think it was even before that, but he wanted to send a probe to Alpha Centauri and get it there at some very large fraction of the speed of light. The proposal was something like this. The probe itself would weigh no more than a typical business letter. In other words, it would be approximately 1 ounce, or what is that, 28 grams or something. And this, we would then use this laser or something that would take 10% of the energy being generated on Earth to send that one envelope to Alpha Centauri at near the speed of light. Now, this, simply the mathematics is where this comes from. This is not somebody's opinion. or, you know, somebody hasn't thought of a new technology. That's just assuming that you are pretty efficient in the technology. So when you start to think how much energy it would take to send an envelope, literally an envelope, to Alpha Centauri, somehow I just can't get too worried about them raising, you know, armadas to come over here and conquer us, or to grab our resources and send them back to Alpha Centauri. It's just not going to happen. If there were any actual interstellar travel, meaning individuals, living beings, and sophisticated machinery and so on, there would have to be giant space arcs, and there have been these proposals that you can build these very giant things up in orbit and then send them at relatively slow velocities, very high velocities compared to our solar system, high velocities compared to ordinary earthly speeds, but very low velocities compared to the speed of light. And the trip would take centuries or thousands of years. So entire generations would live on and die on this artificial world. Essentially, you're building an artificial world and sending. That's possible. I don't know how practical it is. But perhaps something like that might happen. But again, how worried would I be that somebody would have this armada of artificial worlds that have been traveling this way for 10,000 years and are just about to get here and are going to grab our resources and send them back? I just don't think so. I think once you understand how really, and there's no other word for it, than preposterous the proposal of actual physical interstellar travel is, once you understand that point, I don't think you'd be too worried about what, you know, somebody might do, come here and so on. Now, there's still perhaps it's a marginal concern about infectious agents or anything like that. Maybe somebody from Alpha Centauri is sending an envelope to us, and when it gets here, we'll look at it, and maybe it will contain something that will grow and, you know, come working on our bellies or something. And I don't think anything like that is at all likely, but I'm just saying, short of something along the lines of some kind of infectious agent or something, and you could never plan that. Even if somebody tried to plan that for us, they wouldn't know enough about our biosphere to know what would grow and what wouldn't. So it's hard for me to imagine any scenario that is scary along those lines. But if somehow somebody from somewhere else did get here, then I would be worried, at least to some extent. But I just don't see that happening.
It's also the argument that can be made that anyone that did have the ability to get here wouldn't need it. I mean, it takes such a huge amount of resources to get here. If they have all those resources, why do they need to come here and steal our stuff? It just it doesn't make sense.
They might come here to explore, but not to steal it.
Yeah, exactly.
UFO sightings and belief in UFOs is just one of the typical lack of skepticism cases. You know, people not really using their head, thinking about this, thinking things true, being skeptical of what they see. Could this be a useful example in a skepticism class of using these, or would it be useful to bring in this sort of thing to a class for skepticism? Well, I've obviously got a skepticism class in schools. Be useful and using this as an example.
Yes, there are any number of cases that would make a really good example. Philip Glass wrote several instances concerning like airline crews who reported near collisions with unidentified objects that just went whizzing by, very close range, and so on. And it turned out that what they saw was some meteor that was more than 100 miles away, you know, coming in the atmosphere, and or space debris. There's any number of cases like this. Or even more recently, we've learned about the famous Yukon UFO sighting of 1996. A number of people in very scattered locations all saw this brilliant object that they reported as a close encounter UFO, a mothership, whatever. And it turns out it matches precisely the decay, trajectory, and time of a Russian rocket booster. So that's obviously what they saw. But that Russian rocket booster was like 140 kilometers from where they were. And but their mind filled in the details of UFO windows and things like this. So, yes, things like this, I think, make very good examples that for classes to teach skepticism, workshops and things But having said that, I think it'll do any good. I think that people will see this, and I mean, we've all heard the stories of psychics or magicians actually who will go on a TV show and will talk, will, you know, show some tricks and then say, well, I fooled you, I'm a magician, these are just tricks, and don't, you know, believe that when you see things like this. And then they still have people contacting them afterwards who saw the show, and they say, I saw you on this TV show, how much do you charge for a reading? I was like, didn't you see the part where I said I'm a phony? You know? I mean, on the one hand, yes, is there something that should be done? On the other hand, it's probably not going to do a lot of good.
Do you suppose that's because people just, they really want to believe it's true?
Well, clearly that's part of it. Because really the world is a much more interesting place if all this crazy stuff is true. I mean, it's much more interesting to think that there's, you know, creatures from Zeta Reticuli zipping around in the sky and landing in the woods in New Hampshire, that it is to think, oh, it's just a planet, it's just a meteor or whatever. And, I mean, it's a whole different, you know, world. One case, you're walking out there in the woods and you think, well, maybe, you know, I'll see a brown squirrel or maybe I'll even see a moose. And then the other hand, maybe I'll see a flying saucer. Maybe I'll see an alien land, which is more exciting. Maybe I'll see Bigfoot.
We have a question from the chat room. What do you think about the claims about ancient aliens? I can imagine what you think.
Well, yeah.
This whole idea about aliens building the pyramids and stuff like that.
Yeah.
That's from the History Channel.
I think that's what history is, aliens. I thought it was Napoleon and things like that, but they think it's aliens. So I guess there's a different opinion there. Well, yeah, I mean, ancient aliens are even more dubious than the modern claims. They take something that looks a little bit odd, interpreted in a modern sense by modern people who aren't familiar with that culture and with the way that that culture did things, and they say, well, aliens must have done this. Well, it's John Bannikin started that back in, I think, even in the 60s and late 60s. Early 70s, and then something wrote any number of books, and then it's just kind of, it went dead for a while, and I thought, oh, ancient aliens, you know, nobody believes that anymore. That was the 80s and the 90s. You never heard anymore about ancient aliens, or ancient astronauts, as they were then called. And then it started to come back again. So you're never,
Something
happened with Bigfoot. Bigfoot kind of went away for about 15 or 20 years, and nobody was seeing him, nobody cared about him. And now, Bigfoot is, oh man, he's a celebrity. He's a man around town. You know?
Yeah, I think we have Zechariah Sitchin to thank for a lot of the ancient alien claims nowadays. His stuff got really popular around the whole, you know, when the 2012 nonsense
right.
got started.
Right.
That's when we really saw a rise in the popularity of these claims, I think.
What do you make of, like, the History Channel, which kind of started out as kind of fairly legitimate, and it's now just seems to have gone to, I don't know how to describe it.
What can we say? What do they say? Gresham's Law or something is bad currency drives out the good or something, then maybe that applies to television also.
Yeah.
It's not just the History Channel. It's happening all over. You know, the arts and entertainment channel used to be literally arts and entertainment. You have classical music and dance and things like that and concerts on it. And now it has nothing of the kind. And it's got, you know, some entertainment shows and some just far out stuff. And History Channel, as you said, it used to talk about the Second World War and Napoleon and, you know, ancient Rome. And now it talks about ancient aliens. And True TV, I think it used to be Court TV, as I recall. That used to be, if you turned into Court TV, you would have the, you would see actual courtroom video of things like the famous trials, the OJ trial, and so on. And now, it's still sort of crime-related, a lot of it, but it's more like, you know, true police tales, true detective tales, whatever. So it seems to be a whole general trend in television. People want more sensationalism. They don't want this Arts and Entertainment's been having a fine concert on by an opera singer or something. That's not what people want to hear. They want to have, you know, something that's, you know, and it appeals to a more of a common denominator.
Yeah, another problem is that there's no money in telling the truth. The money is in telling people what they want to hear. They don't care. As soon as they realize that there's, you make more money if you show absolute bullshit that people like, that's what you'll show.
Yes. And we see that in so many different things. You know, sometimes skeptics say, well, we've got to do a skeptical show and, you know, put your thing in there. And I say, you know, if you really did a show that was completely fair and showed all of the skeptical reasoning and explanations for these UFOs, nobody would watch it.
Exactly.
They would say, oh, this is BS, this is debunking, this must be, you know, government paid disinformation. I've had any number of people claim that I'm paid by the government to debunk these. Robert Hastings, who's well known in American ufology as a guy who talks about the nuclear missiles and supposedly UFOs knock out nuclear missiles, and or they take them offline for a little while. And he's convinced, he wrote some things saying that I and the other people of the Psycot, now CSI, are in cahoots, being paid by the government to debunk these things. Well, you know, I wish I were, then I wouldn't be driving such an old car. If the CIA would, get up their ass and send me some money, but...
Do you find that kind of the UFO believers, like kind of out of all the, you know, sort of believers in kind of the pseudosciences, are they sort of, you know, they react more favorably, you know, they at least try and engage with the debunkers, like, because like my experience would say, like a 9/11 truther, they're very vitriolic, their defenses are up and they attack you straight away, whereas like my impression, at least with the UFO folk, they do seem to try and engage the debunkers a little bit more.
Well, I would say it would depend on the group. Again, it's difficult to generalize. There's some of them who are reasonable and friendly and not too vitriolic, and you can sit down with them and discuss, and you can disagree or try to make your point, and they'll make their point. But that hasn't been the main experience of ufology for these things. When Phil Klass was alive and when he was active in ufology, several of the well-known ufologists, Alan Hynek and Bud Hopkins and many, many others, they basically had a policy that they would not go on any TV show or panel or anything if Phil Klass was going to be on there, because he was too well-prepared and would make them look foolish. And really, many people take an absolutist position. There's no other way to describe it. For example, the late Bud Hopkins was certainly an absolutist in that he was right and he was simply wrong. There was no point in even discussing it. If you didn't understand what he was saying, it meant you were stupid. And, you know, we still encounter this attitude sometimes. Now, some of them are, you know, more reasonable than that. Also, as I said in a paper I did in the Skeptical Inquirer a few years back, trying to do like a sort of a historical look back at 60 years of UFO claims. Roughly speaking, the UFO movement, the UFO proponents, divide into two camps. One is like the science fiction camp, and these are probably the ones that maybe you're more familiar with, the ones who are claiming that, you know, that extraterrestrials are here and they've built rockets or they have some high technology. And it's the kind of thing you might read in a science fiction story. Whereas there's others that call the New Age type. And to them, it's really different. It's they have a personal relationship with the aliens. And it's a much more religious and spiritual thing with these New Age people. And they're not so interested in sightings. I mean, if you tell them you had a sighting, oh, that's good. Oh, you saw them too. You know, I saw them 3 times last week. They're not that keen on the sightings. They are either channeling or in some way, you know, having a a conversation, or they may meet with the aliens, they may be abducted, and all kinds of things. And they have their stories become just so elaborate as they start telling them. It's almost like they don't get somebody to listen to their story very often. And so when there's a person, or better yet, a group of people, like they say at a UFO meeting, you get a chance to tell their story. They just go into all the little details, and the aliens said this, and our planet is this, and we're here because you're destroying your planet with pollution and radiation and whatever and whatever. And then it all ties in with psychic stuff because they claim, telepathic communication, psychic powers. So it's this new age thing is really very different than the science fiction type. It's a whole different role that it plays in people's lives.
These are the people who claim that the Illuminati is made up of numbers, and Jews come from space, apparently. Hebrews come from space. They're aliens, apparently. I don't know. I don't know if there's some anti-Semitism involved there or whatever. But it's so ridiculous. It's just you want to laugh your ass off until you realize that this guy actually believes this,
and he votes. Yeah. So they, George Adamski and others that talk about the Nordics, tall, blonde Nordic UFO people. Nobody ever talks about, short Mexican UFO people. And in fact, I've talked with a few Asians who say that, they hear this kind of talk and they say, oh, wait a minute, if those guys are the Nordics and they're good and they're tall and they're blonde, they're the good aliens, does that mean I'm bad because I'm brown?
Okay. Another thing that UFO believers keep yapping on about crop circles. Are there any unexplained ones? Because I keep hearing that all the time. I mean, we all know how they're done. The people who started it went out in public and say, "Here's how it's done," and then of course other people started doing it and making it more and more elaborate. But every now and then you keep hearing about, oh, no one can explain this one. And this one has this magical field around it that kills cameras or whatever.
We don't get so much of that on this side of the Atlantic. Those kind of crop circles aren't really common. I was just noticing there was on the NBC television news about 2 days ago, it was a story they had. It was called Farm Tourism. And it had to do with how some of the farms in the U.S. are bringing in tourists, like around Halloween and the corn stalks and, and all this and that. And one of the things that they do is they make mazes in the corn. And the farmer does this. And the people wander through and try to find their way through the maze. And then they had some aerial photos of these crops with these patterns in them. And my God, it was amazing. And some of them had written words, God bless America or something like that in the, that could only be seen from the sky. But it was really quite remarkable. And as I said, the farmers themselves did this, got some helpers to do that. So it's quite easy to make complex patterns in a crop. Now, why it's done? Well, like we said, why are these video hoaxes done? Probably for all of those reasons that we mentioned before.
And if it brings in tourism, I mean, that's a reason to do it. So
exactly.
We do have a question from Angry Wombo. She's PM me there. What is the craziest piece of UFO evidence you've ever seen? I mean, the one that's left you just completely floored and speechless.
Lord and speechless that anybody would believe it was. Well, I went on this UFO tour in Mexico. This was 1996. This was back when there was a big wave of sightings in Mexico. The claim was made that in Mexico City, that UFOs were being seen so frequently that if you just were near the airport in Mexico City, you go there at any time and see UFOs. And, well, obviously that couldn't be true, and obviously that wasn't true. but it was clean. And we went down there, and we went to the very places where, you know, the most sightings had been reported. And we went to, in fact, this one guy's house. We stopped off there because he was one of the witnesses, and he wanted to show us his evidence. And well, he claimed that a UFO had landed in their backyard a couple nights ago. And he pointed to, there was a stick on the ground. And the stick was broken. Cracked. And it wasn't, it was, you know, bent. Cracked. And he pointed to it and said, the UFO did that. I was speechless.
As far as I'm concerned, the odds of us being the only life form in the universe is pretty small. Does that mean I think that they've visited us? No, not at all. If there is life elsewhere, do you think it's probably likely that it's evolved somewhere along the same lines that we have? Or would you expect it to be somewhere further ahead evolutionary than we are?
Well, I'm not sure that evolution has forward and backwards, or has a start, or has a a goal. So, in the sense, I think it's a misconception to think that all the species of this planet and other planets are racing forward to a more highly evolved form, and that's really not how it works. People say it's the survival of the fittest, but really, it's the survival of the fit enough. Again, it's conjecture. And when I think about how large the universe is, if you've seen the Hubble Deep Space, that one photo, which was just a tiny little piece of the sky, so tiny you could hardly even see it as a little square with your eye. And then when it's magnified, it is just thousands and thousands of galaxies as far as can be seen. And the notion that none of those galaxies out there has any planet anywhere with life on it, and has none of them has any planet with intelligent creatures on it, I simply can't believe that. Given the size of the universe, I simply cannot believe that there is more than out there. But again, we talked about the distances. We talked about how amazingly difficult it would be to send an envelope, just an envelope, to Alpha Centauri. And that, by the way, that does not involve it actually stopping or not sufficient energy to. I guess maybe there was some way they were going to beam turn around or something. Maybe they were and you stop it. I'm trying to go, no, I think they could stop it. But anyway, but the point is you're just trying to send an envelope to Alpha Centauri and you're putting this phenomenal amount of energy into it. So imagine if you wanted to send a spacecraft with life support for a breeding population of humans and everything they would need, and chickens and cows and pigs who I hope will like to keep up for a few thousand years. You just think of how impractical that whole thing is. I just don't expect that really to happen. So I agree with what Sheila was saying, in that the likelihood of there actually being intelligent life in the universe, I think, is extremely high. Whether they make it here is dubious, almost beyond belief. Now, radio contact, SETI, that's possible. But again, I suspect that they're intelligent beings are far enough apart and sufficiently uncommon, it's going to be very difficult to find them with radio. But still, it could possibly happen someday. And I think it's something that's worth trying with these, relatively modest efforts. I wouldn't spend a huge amount of money on SETI because the likelihood of it coming off isn't that great. But I think it's reasonable to spend a little bit on it, just like so many other areas of scientific research, and see what we'll find.
Do you have a question from Camille, who's asking, what are the top three reasons you feel are holding back civilization from scientific advancement?
There are a number of things. Part of it is simply human envy and resentment against others who have maybe made you look bad. I mean, if you and I are competing in some effort and you beat me, well, if I'm a good sport and I'm, raised to be polite and fair and everything, then I'll shake your hand and so on. But a lot of people are not like that. And if you get further ahead of them and say, who do you think you are? You're such a, you think you're so smart. We see this all the time in the schools. The bullies like to beat up on the smart kid, the you know, skinny little kid with the glasses and the science book.
How much do you think a profit motive is involved with the UFO conspiracy people?
Well, and in some cases it is, but I think it's only in a relatively few such cases. If you look at the people who are going around and giving lectures, not just occasionally, but making almost a career out of going around to UFO conferences and such and giving lectures, or selling large numbers of books, not just one or two here and there. You look at somebody like Whitney Strieber, how many books has he sold? It's truly amazing. He's written, I don't know, a dozen or something titles, and most all of them have been extremely successful. So, yes, for people like this, there's obviously a large amount of money that is at stake there, and so it's obvious that, you know, you have to consider that profit motive. But I think it's not that common. If the average person goes out and thinks that they see something in the sky and maybe even reports it or tells people about it, I don't think that's done with any thought of money. It's, like I said, only the career ufologists, those who go and give a lot of lectures and write a lot of books and get paid for it. There is certainly the proper motive for people like that.
Do you have anything currently that you're working on? What's your current project at the moment?
Well, I suppose there's always something. There isn't any one big project I'm working on now. In many ways, that when you're a skeptic on any one of these things, UFOs and Bigfoot and so on, in a sense, you're reactive. In that I'm not going forth and, you know, thinking that there is no UFO, that there are no UFOs. Rather, I wait until somebody comes up and says, look at this amazing evidence that I have here. And then I and my colleagues, the other skeptics, look at it. And we see, and generally we don't agree with that, but we take a look at it. So in that sense, it is fairly reactive. There are some cases that are just ongoing that you're always trying to more information about. Betty and Barney Hill is as many years as that's gone on, more than 50 years, and yet we still have new developments in it as people look into Betty Hill's archives and letters at the University of New Hampshire. So I mean, these things are ongoing, and many other you know, photos that are still controversial and trying to, you know, as much information from them as possible, but mostly it is a reactive kind of a thing rather than
active. You were saying you can actually make a good career out of, well, being a ufologist, like a believer. Is it quite a lucrative career from what you've seen of the people promoting it?
For a small number of people, it is.
Yeah.
I mentioned Whitney Strieber earlier. He wrote in the he was already a well-known writer of horror fiction during the 1980s. And then in 1987, he wrote Communion, which was basically a tale of alien contact, although he didn't call them aliens. He called them the visitors, but they have all the characteristics of what, you know, people claim are aliens. And then more books, Confirmation, and then some of them were fictional books, fictionalized, but based on facts and so on and so on. And every year or so, he comes out with another book, and these books sell pretty amazingly well, just amazingly well. And so, obviously, in his case, in the case of the late Bud Hopkins, he wrote books, and he also did a lot of things. He went around and gave talks. He had these foundations and organizations for people who think that they are contactees or who think that they have been abducted. And I'm sure there's money in that, too. Look at Stephen Greer, how much money he appears to be making off this. Movie, if you go out in the desert, if you want to learn how to make interstellar contact, then you will, for something like $2,500, you can join a group of people out in the desert at night where you can find flashlights and lasers up at the sky. And if something went back at you, well, that's evidence of an interstellar contact.
One thing we haven't really touched on this show is abductees. What's been your experience? Have you spoken to many, well, alleged abductees, and just what's your general experience speaking to them?
I don't, on a regular basis, don't talk to them, but I have, you know, run into many people at UFO conferences and elsewhere who believe they have had contact with aliens or believe they have been abducted. And obviously, I mean, it's in every case, there's no real evidence that proves that is the sort of a thing. I mean, in fact, some people are making a very potentially lucrative and interesting thing. They have, you know, Dr. Roger Lear claims to take implants, alien implants out of people surgically. And, of course, what you get is just some little piece of something, and nobody can say what it is, and it does not really appear to be an intelligent manufacturer, but then that's what an alien would make. Like, say, these things may be you know, just a millimeter or two long, and really the body is full of foreign objects. A lot of people have pieces of wood and little scraps of metal and so on that actually get embedded in their arm. Some people can imagine these to be alien devices. And then they take that there's like stud finders. In fact, you know, you go to the hardware store, this device is called a stud finder. You put batteries in it, and then supposedly it's, you know, it beeps or something. When you're going over and, you know, finds it, basically it's magnetic and it detects the nails inside the wall. Well, they take the same thing and they run it over people's bodies. To find anything, or it just as it appears to change, because I guess the electric field changes depending on, you know, static field or whatever, different parts of your body, and they interpret this as, you know, the presence or the absence of alien impact. So there's some very elaborate fantasies going on there.
How scientifically literate do you find ufologists? Because I remember I used to. You know, I used to have a kind of little interest, and I did buy some copies of UFO magazine, which is near the UK. And what I found was there was a lot of kind of quite interesting physics and engineering articles. And it struck me that they do know quite a bit of science, but it's just the kind of the jump they're making from that science to what they're believing. But do you find that yourself? They are actually, they do tend to be quite knowledgeable on science.
Well, some of them do. Like I said, if you... You divide the UFO community up into the two groups of the science fiction ufologists and the New Age. And the New Age people don't know anything about science, and they just go on and talk about, you know, quantum this and, oh, well, the alien told me that they live at a higher level of vibration than we do. Which makes no sense scientifically, but it sounds scientific. They think they're being scientific. Whereas the others, the science fiction ufologists, they may have a good knowledge of science in some cases, but they're just so eager to apply it to try to make something extraterrestrial. They'll talk all about fusion drives and how you could build something like this and get tremendous energy from it if you could harness nuclear fusion. And in theory, yes, that's true, but then if you start to figure out how much fuel you would have to take if you wanted to go to an interstellar destination at some significant fraction of the speed of light, it's phenomenally much, even if you were 100% efficient, and then you would have to accelerate the fuel so that you could stop. Otherwise, it'll just go right past your destination when you get there. So the payload has to include the fuel that will slow you down. So you basically squared the amount of fuel that you need. And they don't either don't realize this or they don't want to go through and actually work out what you would actually have to do to make something like that practical. So it's, you know, it looks sciencey. It's the sizzle of science without the thoroughness of going through and figuring out the whole complete package that goes along with it.
Yeah, I get the same impression. If you look at things like these proposed ideas of how a warp drive would work, you know, the whole idea of creating gravity and anti-gravity fields that warp space so you don't actually have to travel faster than light in order to get from A to B faster than light. I mean, these are ideas that actually work on paper as long as you don't, I mean, just don't look at how much energy it would require. Right. And then these people will basically just say, well, you see, these aliens are so advanced that they have an energy source that they can take care of that. And that sort of solves the problem. So they get to insert whatever sci-fi technology right. They want if it seems remotely plausible on paper.
Take something that seems remotely plausible, but ignore the details of how it would actually be done. Or they'll say, like you said, oh, they have some advanced energy source. Well, again, if you go onto my Bad UFOs blog and in the search box up in the corner, type in the word preposterous, and an article about is interstellar travel preposterous will come up. And the idea is, even if we grant that they have, given that E equals MC squared, that's the maximum energy you could get from any mass. And, of course, you're going to have losses in terms of, you know, heat leakage, and no machine is 100% efficient, and not all the energy you generate is going to go into thrust, and not all of your thrust is going to go in the right direction, and so on and so on. But let's forget about all those details. Let's assume that you could solve all that. You still calculate the amount of hydrogen that you would have to bring with you to fuse into helium, or even if you could take matter and antimatter and put them together and make gamma rays. I don't know how much you're going to put the antimatter in, what you're going to build the tank out of, but even if you, or where you're going to get it from in the first place, all this antimatter, but even, well, let's assume that's the mere technical detail. Let's assume you have all that. Still, calculate the amount that you need. You still need huge amounts of fuel to accelerate this thing, and then you need to square that amount in order to have enough to stop. I mean, if you have a ratio of, I forget what it was, 101 or something, then it would be better than that if you could do antimatter. But, you know, that your fuel for deceleration has to be considered a payload. You have to accelerate the payload with an even greater amount. So it's something that's on paper that looks like it might be possible, but when you work out the details, you realize it's total preposterous.
Okay, someone in the chat is mentioning David. I guess it's not UFOs, but it is a
David Icke. You realize who the lizard people are? They are, but they're extraterrestrials. They're Draconians or something like that. I think they're supposed to come from the constellation of Draco because, you know, Draco the dragon, and so obviously dragon people and lizard people have to come from that constellation. And but anyway, all of there's a secret rule in society, and of course you realize that the royal family in the UK are counted among lizard people, and in that they need to have human DNA. Human blood apparently enables them to stay in their non-reptilian form, and so this is an ongoing cannibalism. But we shouldn't feel too smug on this side of the Atlantic, because I think many of our families, I think that the Bush family and the Clinton family and even Al Gore and a few others are all part of this lizard people. They're lizard people also. So I guess we just have to be really careful and really vigilant to not fall into their clutches. He's got a lot of conspiracies, not just lizard people. I'm trying to remember what they all are. I think they're just standard, you know, Illuminati and international bankers and whatever and whatever. Yeah, he's got a lot of really interesting things.
I think for the most part, and part of the reason why it's such a high dollar area to get into is most people live somewhere in between the really technical science people, you know, the what it would take to actually get there, and the new age people who just think it's all fluffy, magical. For the average person, if the ones who can walk away with a little piece of metal or whatever and think that they've actually got some sort of evidence are a lot like the same people who walk away from like a psychic fair with getting their aura read or, you know, whatever. I think it's just, it gives them something tangible to hold on to. which is why it's such a high money making area. You know, it gives them hope and potential tangible evidence, I guess.
There's an ongoing subculture of this new age ufology. It doesn't involve so much sightings or abductions or anything like that, although there may be abductions, but mostly it involves people wanting to contact. I'll tell you, each one of these people who sets himself up as a sort of a guru, a new age UFO guru, will tell a different story about how this, somebody might say, well, I'm in touch with the Pleiadians, and somebody else say, well, I'm in touch with the Boons, the Orions, and so on. And they have these ongoing conferences and, weekends where somebody will get up. And a lot of this will try to tie it in with Native American spirituality and so on. With the, if you talk to an anthropologist, they'll basically say you got it all wrong. So that's not what it is. Native American religious ideas are, but it's like you said, the fluffy, warm, happy thoughts and pixie dust kind of ufology, and that we're all, peace and love, and it's wonderful, peace and love, but, there's that guy out there with a gun, it's not going to stop him, peace and love. So it's a feel-good kind of thing on that side of the equation.
We do have a question from the chat room. It's Skin Doggy Dog, it's the name. He is asking, how many people that at least you're aware of have you managed to bring over to the skeptic side with your writings and blogs and just in general?
That's an interesting question, and the answer is I really wouldn't know for sure. There are a few people who will tell you that they started out as a believer and then started to read some of the skeptics. Literature, not necessarily mine, but maybe they read a book by Phil Flass, or maybe they read, one of my books, or Jim Olberg, or somebody like that, and gradually they, came over to being skeptical about it. But I don't know that I can, these tales of dramatic conversion or unconversion are pretty uncommon. I don't really know that I could any number, but I've talked to at least a few people who have said that I would certainly help them bring them around and couldn't take full credit for it myself.
I find that there are plenty of people who just, they're smart people, but they're just horribly ignorant, and they're exposed to one side, the woo peddlers, basically, and they can actually be turned over pretty easily if they just hear the counter arguments. They'll just go, oh, wait a minute, that is stupid, why didn't I think of that? And I've been at this for a couple of years, and I've been getting messages from people saying things like that to me, like, wow, you mentioned something that I hadn't thought of. Yeah, I was believing something completely stupid. So that happens.
Well, it does happen, but it doesn't. I haven't found it to happen that often. And usually once they get started down this path, they build, they invest intellectual capital in it. And especially if they've told all their friends that, yes, UFOs are real, I've seen them. You don't want to say, oh, by the way, I think what I saw was just the re-entry of a Russian rocket booster. They know it was something extraterrestrial.
Yeah, and exactly.
Especially if they told people, well, I've had channeling of the extraterrestrials, I've been abducted, and so on and so on. And to say, well, really, that was probably a dream, it has to do with sleep paralysis. They're not going to say that. And partly because of the intellectual capital they've invested, partly because of the potential embarrassment, saying, well, what am I stupid to believe that? And partly it's just, it's a much more interesting world if, there's aliens popping in and out of my bedroom than if I'm just having silly dreams.
something we come across a lot with our guests, and I suppose the kind of approach you must take is, you know, you're not going to convert, you know, say like David Icke, you know, with your blog posts and that, but it's kind of people who maybe have watched a little bit too much History Channel. You know, if it just gets them thinking about it, that's kind of really what you should be aiming for.
Oh, yes, yeah. Yes, that realistic. Even many of the people, you know, I often go to the UFO meetings and groups where, you know, they're mostly believers, and I don't, you know, go in there and say, you people are all stupid, this is crazy stuff, this, you know, this guy is telling a lie, and so on and so on. I just listen, you know, I hear some amazingly stupid stories. We heard the guy who was the photographer or something, who was accompanying Zechariah Sitchin on his travels around South America and wherever else. And a lot of interesting stuff. Totally not much claims I could believe, but just listen. And but what you can do in a situation like that is you can say, remember when he said such and such? Well, you know what? That's wrong, because here's this other fact that shows that what he said there is wrong. And they can accept that. That, okay, that one thing he said is wrong, especially if you can demonstrate. Just leave it at that. So that they, you know, that seed is planted in their mind, and maybe when they hear there's a similar situation in the future, they'll say, well, that sounds pretty wild, so I better check it out.
Say, like, for instance, anyone who's watching this, say, over the weekend, one of our friends, oh, I saw this really weird thing in the sky. You know, what else could it be? How do you approach that? You know, when it's someone you kind of know and trust, and they're usually quite rational.
Well, you know, it just, it would depend on what it was. Often, you know, people are just seeing Venus or they're seeing a meteor.
Yeah.
And in some cases, if you say, well, you know, it sounds very much like a meteor, what you're describing. Sometimes they'll accept that, sometimes they won't, or sometimes they'll say, oh, I couldn't have made meteor, it did this, it did that. But again, it's not all details that a person is going to remember are always going to be correct, and especially if they've told the story to other people several times and told it over to themselves and gone over in their own mind again and again. So, often, you know, people will accept something like that, unless you're talking about the people who are just so, you know, if you're talking to one of these new age UFO people, it's almost like a person who is like deeply religious, that they're just surrounded by miracles. You know, when somebody's, let's say, a very strict Catholic or something, and they, you know, everything that they see, you know, this favorable this or that, is, oh, God did this, God did that, you know, because that's part of their mindset. And these new age UFO people, I mean, if you tell them that you talked, you channeled aliens last night, they wouldn't question that at all, because, I mean, channeling aliens, and it's just something that people do every day, you know. So it's part of their mindset. And if you said, well, I saw a UFO hovering over my house last night, they're not going to say, well, it was probably Venus. They're going to say, oh, yeah, I saw one about the week ago, too. Yeah, there's many ways that people will interpret these things.
We do have another question from Camille. Just to let everyone know, we're coming up for the last 4 minutes of the show, so it is quite a good question here. How do you feel with the, like, say it was confirmed that there was aliens tomorrow, how do you think that would affect the culture, just in general?
Well, it would be the biggest news story of all time. So, I mean, if we mean that if aliens were actually here, as opposed to if aliens were, like, contacted by SETI, you know, on the radio, if aliens were actually here, then that would be the biggest news story of the time. In fact, there was a TV show about this. What was the name of that series where they supposedly, I can't even call it now, but a few years ago, where they, you know, the premise of the show was that aliens had come with their technology openly and it changed everything. But then they also, you know, the question is, can we really trust what these aliens are telling us? So, yeah, it would be a huge, complex, and amazing thing, but, you know, it's pure speculation at this point in time.
How about if it's just a radio signal? What do you think would happen then?
I think it would still be profound, although there would be no immediate sense that, you know, everything is going to change, that next week will be we'll be living a different kind of life than we're living today. But we would undoubtedly try to extract as much information from it as we can. Remember that because of the enormous distances involved, it would not be a two-way link, or at least not for a very long time. I mean, they're 100 light years away, which is still relatively close. Even if we send an answer to them today, it's going to be 100 years before they get it, and then another 100 years before we hear them say that they got it from us. So, but I could imagine that over very long periods of time that we might set up something like that. Say we discover somebody who is 200 light years away, and we establish a two-way radio link. And, of course, this is something that takes place over many, you know, centuries. But I could see that we would maybe give a beam, our reflected beam, our data and our, you know, information about our culture and our planet to them, and they would do the same to us. And that, you know, this would be ongoing, I would think.
It's coming up. So I think probably the last question to take us out, Megan. What kind of materials or books in general would you recommend for anyone just wanting to get involved, started with skepticism, to build their skeptical skills?
Well, there's a lot of ways to do that. A lot of information, a lot of organizations have information for you. In the U.S., we have CSI, I mentioned. They publish a magazine called The Skeptical Inquirer. It has an online presence. You know, you can also go to Facebook, for example, and you could like The Skeptical Inquirer, and then you will get little news updates and things from them. Same thing with the Skeptic Society in California, which is Michael Shermer's group, and they have a magazine that you can read online also. I believe they have like a Kindle version of it, and they also have online Facebook and information and things. JREF is the James Randi Educational Foundation. They also have online materials, and they have them. If you can make it to Las Vegas in July, that's like sort of like the Woodstock for skeptics each year at one of the large casinos in Las Vegas. And more than 1,000 skeptics get together and have a great big party, and usually Penn and Teller are there, and all kinds of very interesting people. So if you want to have a lot of fun and make a lot of skeptical friends and get to know a whole lot more about these things, if you can make it to the Amazing Meeting or TAM, that's something I would highly recommend. Also, there's skeptical organizations in the UK, in Australia, I mean, in almost every major country. There's, I know in Italy, some of the Italian skeptics come to our meetings here in the U.S. And I would say find out what, you know, in your country is some of the largest skeptical organizations, and join them, see if they have anything online that you can read, if they have a magazine that you can read, and perhaps even if they hold a conference where you can get together and meet people with similar thoughts to yourself.
Okay, we're coming up to the end of the show, so as always, I'll just go around the panel for the final thoughts. I'm just going by the order you appear on my screen, so Marty.
I've got something, except it was great to have you on.
Sheila.
Well, I guess thanks for the opportunity to let me not only have me on here, but to get a chance to listen in on what Robert had to say. Very cool. Thank you.
All right, John Kitch.
Thanks for coming on. It's been pretty good to have you on.
You're going Dalek on us all of a sudden. Got an Irish Dalek on the show now to finish it off nicely.
You again, Kitch.
You or say exterminate to be sure, just to give us. You're still the same. Just mute Kitch in general. That's a great way to end the show. And Robert, your final thoughts, please, and any soapbox stuff you want to do right now.
Not too much of soapbox, but. Not too much old boxing here. I would say if you want to stay in touch with what I'm doing, read the Bad UFOs blog, badufos.com, and also look on Facebook for some of the you know, Skeptical Inquirer, Skeptic Society, JRAP, and so on. That's how you'll keep in touch, I would say, with new developments. And if anything really significant or interesting comes up on UFOs, I try to put it onto the Bad UFOs blog and also some human.
Okay, big thank you to Rob. It's been a fascinating discussion. And coming up for you, we're back on Saturdays, and next week we have Mr. Matt Dillahunty joining us, which is sure to be, if you remember what happened last year, it's going to be interesting to say the least. So thank you all, everyone chatting. Big thumbs up to Rob, and we'll see you all on Saturday, same time. Good night, everyone, and have a great weekend.
See you.